So this was a project. There's actually, there were three books involved. Well, there were several books. There were three books I've written two of, and I'm writing a third one, all about Fibonacci. I didn't set out to write three books. I set out to write maybe one book. And this was around 2002. I sort of had this idea late, around 1999, 2000, that period, that I wanted to write a book about Fibonacci. Why? Because, as has just been mentioned, I've spent a lot of my career doing mathematical outreach, trying to take deep ideas and make them accessible. Very few mathematicians try to do that, but one of the ones who did very successfully was Leonardo of Pisa, as we now call him, Fibonacci. With a series of books, he had an incredible impact on the development of the modern world, and it was partly because he had the mathematical ability, the mathematical chops to just do deep mathematics. And deep mathematics then basically was arithmetic and the beginnings of algebra. But he had the capacity to do that well ahead of his era. But he also had not only the ability to write about it in a moderately accessible way, I say moderately accessible because of the audience he was going for, but he also had incredible marketing sense. Because as every good teacher knows, it's marketing, marketing, marketing. It's not just technology that needs marketing. You have to market it, and you have to make that person want to know what you're talking about. That is marketing. And that's basically one of the things we do. It's the same in Killer Through Truth as well. It's marketing and creating excitement. And around 2002, I actually started to do this work. And these images were all taken. This is Pisa, this was in 2002. It was not my first visit to Italy, but the first of what was going to be very many visits to, particularly to the Tuscan area, Siena, Florence, that general area, and Pisa. Because Leonardo was born and grew up and spent most of his life in Pisa, so I wanted to go there. No one had written the history of Leonardo. I'm going to call him Leonardo because he's, in my mind he's a friend of mine, and I don't want to call him by his vulgar nickname. So he was Leonardo. He was later in his life Leonardo of Pisa because he was a respected gentleman. So I'm going to call him Leonardo. And not only did he live in Pisa, but many of the buildings that were around him, when he was living at the time when the Leaning Tower was built and started to lean, and the Campo Santo and the cathedral and things, it was around that time, beginning of the 13th century. And many of the buildings in Pisa, which is Italy, and they don't knock buildings down. In California, they knock a building down every 20 years. You put it down to the ground and rebuild it. But in Pisa, you leave them up until they actually fall down, and most of them don't. So you walk around Pisa today, and you're walking the streets looking at things that Leonardo would have looked at. And like, part of the reason people didn't write a history was there was nothing known about him. So for a standard historian, no one could write a history of Leonardo. There just isn't any, because there's really nothing to go on. But I'm not an ordinary historian. I'm not a historian at all. I'm a pretend historian. Although I've spent a lot of time in the archives on this project. But what I am is a mathematician that was able to get into his mind. And so through his writings, get a sense of him, and by going to Italy many times, wandering around and trying to imagine what it was like in the 13th century, reading his own words in the original Latin, one of the few benefits of my English school experience was I was forced to learn Latin. And of course I said for years, what a waste of time, I will never need that, well now I've used it. So I've actually got great benefit out of it. You know? It's like Steve Jobs taking a course on fonts. You know, why does someone take a course on fonts? Why do you end up designing the graphical user interface computer where fonts are important? So these things, you know, this is the classic liberal arts thing. Learn it, file it away, you probably use it one day or another. And indeed I use my Latin on this project. So I went about this book by trying to get at Leonardo through his writings, because after all, his impact, and I'll say a little bit about what his impact was, it's much bigger than you can possibly imagine, and bigger than I imagined at the beginning. His impact on the world was so great, but that impact was through his mathematics. So in a sense, the minutiae of Leonardo's life doesn't matter, because the impact was Leonardo the mathematician, Leonardo the citizen of Pisa. And those things we have access to. We have a lot of story, we have a lot of history about 13th century Italy and Pisa. There's a lot of information in the archives about what it was like then, what it's like to live there. What we're missing is just the details of his social activity. I did find one thing that wasn't generally known, that he actually had a brother. That was new. I didn't discover that. Someone who did discover that told me that. Because if you speak Latin, if you learn Latin, you can pick up Italian. And I started talking to some Italian scholars, medieval scholars, and they told me all sorts of things that had only been published in Italian, which means American scholars never read them, right? Well, I did. Okay, so this is the River Arno. And this is what Pisa looks like today. But back in the 13th century, that was one of the most important ports in the world. There was Florence, there was Pisa, later on there was Venice, Genoa. These were the big ports that were dealing across the Mediterranean. The basic trade route was the Silk Route from North Africa down into the Orient. And so you had all of the stuff coming from the Orient north of the Silk Route, carried by the Muslim traders on camels, put into ships on the north ports of Bugia and so forth, sent across to Europe. So this was the beginning of international trade in a global sense. And the Mediterranean was one of the hubs, and one of the biggest hubs in this network was Pisa. Now Pisa, if you've been to Italy, you realise Pisa is miles from the coast, it's about 15 miles from the coast, beautiful bike ride. If you're a cyclist, there's nothing better than doing research in Tuscany. You take your bike with you, and in the mornings you're in the archives, and in the afternoon you're riding through vineyards, and in the evening you're drinking the wine that was grown in the vineyards. It doesn't get much better than that, and I used to hate going back, although going back to California was kind of nice, but it's still hard to leave Tuscany. Pace of life is very nice there. Okay, so, but if you realise it's miles from the coast, and that's not a deep river. So how did it work? Well, these were flat-bottom boats. What happened was there was a thing called the Port of Pisano, Port of Pisa, which is where Livorno, the big sea-going port, is now. So there was a big seaport on the Mediterranean, and things were brought across the Mediterranean in the sailboats. They were offloaded and then put into shallow barges and taken up to Pisa and then to Florence. And that was where the hub was. Pisa was particularly one of the hubs of international trade. And Leonardo was born in a family where his father was a trader and a government official. So he grew up in this world. And this is how we can start to put together a picture of Leonardo. And what I did was I would go there and say, imagine I'm Leonardo, I'm a mathematician, I understand his mathematics, I've read his works. What would it feel like? If I'd seen this, what would I have thought? And then recreate this individual. Okay, so let's go a little bit further back in time than 2002. If you went to Pisa in 1944, right towards the end of the Second World War, and you go to the River Arno, looking across what used to be the central bridge, it's ruins there, you will see that there'd been one incredible battle there. And this was a battle between the Germans and the Italians on one side, and the Allies, the Americans and the Brits and so forth, on the other side. And they basically, just knocked whatever out of this thing. They completely destroyed all sorts of things to try and get across that river and just advance. So a huge battle. Destroyed almost everything. It's since been rebuilt. That building there, it's obviously, when you look at what's going on, the Allies were certainly trying to avoid destroying really beautiful buildings, thank you. And so they didn't completely destroy that, but it got knocked about quite a bit. And the buildings to the side got completely demolished, as did the bridge. I took that photo when I went there in 2002 or 2003. So it's been nicely restored to its original. But focus now on that. Because in the middle of all this destruction and carnage, a marble statue about 8 foot tall remained virtually intact. Nothing hit that thing. So either by good luck or fortune or whatever, that marble statue remained undamaged. If you see it today, if you want to see it today, you have to go to the Campo Santo, which is in the Piazza di Miracoli, where the Leaning Tower and the Cathedral are. There's a sort of a big building at the back, the Camposanto, the Monumental Cemetery. And in that building, you will find that statue, beautifully repolished and put on display right at the end of a long corridor in a very, very spectacular location. And that's a statue, a 19th century statue. It was created in about 1863, something like that, by a Florence sculptor. And that is one of two images we have of, quotation marks, Leonardo of Pisa, because no one knows what he looked like. No drawings were made in his time. Obviously, where they didn't survive. We have no knowledge of what he looked like, but a 19th century Italian sculptor created an image of Leonardo, and that's the image we have. It's the image I used in my work. I mean, I saw that image. I tried to imagine myself inside that body and walking around Pisa. Which is sort of what you think. It sounds kind of hokey to me. But when you think about it, most history is kind of hokey because you're recreating stuff. And however you do it, you just use the best tools you have to recreate it. That statue survived. If you look at it, actually, it's holding a book. important to realise he's holding a book, so it wasn't, you know, this was representing the fact that he wrote a very influential book. There are some tips of fingers missing. However, they are missing in a very clean fashion, and the suspicion is Allied troops took them as souvenirs afterwards. So probably in houses across Ohio and Illinois, you find on a mantel shelf somewhere the end of a finger, and people will say, oh, that's where my grandfather brought that back from Italy. And maybe one day it'll get reunited with the original. But other than that, there was no damage to this thing. It's a statue of Leonardo in 16. It's one of two images we have. The other one is taken from a woodcutter cutting, which is a little bit earlier, to which colour has been added by some person with Photoshop to try and create a sense of this person. Appropriately, another present time, it's purple. Lived from around 1170 to around 1250, as far as we know. Spent most of his life in Pisa, so the dates are iffy. The Pisa part is known, and his father was an international businessman. We know some of this because Leonardo left a brief record of his life. If he hadn't, we'd have no knowledge whatsoever, but what little we have comes from Leonardo himself. Okay, he then travelled to Bugia when he was a teenager. He learnt arithmetic in the schools. I mean, people in those days learnt basic arithmetic. He'd learnt it. He had a flair for it. He had a good mathematical mind. And so when his father went across to North Africa to the port of Bugia to represent the Pisan traders, act as a sort of trading representative, customs official, he invited his son to join him a few years later, when he was old enough, to help him in that work. And when he did so, Leonardo goes across, takes a boat and goes across, actually travels by horse to Livorno, to the port of Pisa, gets on a ship. Then typically ships didn't cross the Mediterranean, they went all the way around the edge of the Mediterranean, they hugged the shores, both for navigation and in particular to avoid storms. So these were long journeys of several weeks. So this teenager on his own goes to North Africa. And when he's there, he sees the Muslim traders in the cafes on the seafront there, and the trading was all done on the sea, on the front of the Mediterranean, on the shore there. He saw them using this method of calculation, using these 10 representations of these digits 0 through 9, and using the traditional methods that are still being taught today. Now, many people were using those in that part of the world, and many people would have come from Pisa, including Leonardo's father, and seen that, and they would have thought, oh, it's kind of cute. Well, Leonardo did more. He thought, not only, and we know this by looking at the way he wrote his book. He looked at that and said, this is not just cute, this is huge. This is absolutely huge. This is a way of giving people, anybody, the ability to do arithmetic, which is the essential ingredient you need to set up in commerce and trade. And this is a world where there was trade, commerce, and engineering. And there's one thing you need for trade, commerce, and engineering, you need arithmetic, and you need to be able to do it. Or you need to be able to hire people to do it. So Leonardo clearly realised that this was a way of democratising arithmetic, that you could give it to everybody. The weird thing is, the people who'd been using it for several hundred years, namely the Muslim traders, picked it up, but didn't sort of, and they used it, they recognised its utility, but no one seems to have sort of realised that it could carry you further. It wasn't that they were stupid, it's just that the world wasn't ready for it. The circumstances in the 13th century were such that when someone reflects on the power of arithmetic, it could have a big impact. It's like the personal computing revolution in the 60s. It was only when microchips became cheap and widely available that you could put a computer in everyone's hands. It turns out, and I'll talk about this later, that Silicon Valley in the 1960s, 70s, 80s in particular, it had all happened in 13th century Tuscany, down to the most fine detail. It's remarkable how that was history recapitulating on itself.
Question. Bugia is not a name that's familiar to me. Is the city still there? What is it called?
Yes, but it's called, it's got several names. That's the old, one of the old Latin names.
What country is it?
It's probably now in, it's hard to say now, because I think it's now called Libya, but who knows what country that is. It's sort of that part of the world, sort of North Liberty, Tunisia sort of area. It's got three names, and I'm If I'd given this talk 7 or 8 years ago when the book was new, it would have been fresh in my mind, but it's Bougie is one of them.
Go on.
Yeah, yeah. Easily found. Okay. Okay. That system then had been, it was the system that the Indian mathematicians, the Hindu mathematicians had developed in the first several centuries of the current era. It was picked up by these traders, the Muslim traders travelling up and down. They recognised its utility and they started using it. And it allowed you to do a couple of things that were really important for trade. Prior to that system becoming available, there were various ways of doing arithmetic. First of all, certainly when in Europe, a lot of the numbers were recorded by Roman numerals. The bookkeeping people in Florence, for example, all of the records were done in Roman numerals. Now, Roman numerals is fine for recording numbers. It makes addition and subtraction trivial, but boy, it's not well suited for multiplication and division, which are the key operations you need for doing trade and commerce. So prior to this system becoming available, there were two methods that traders and people in commerce would use to do arithmetic. One, they used an abacus board, just a board with ruled lines and pebbles, and you moved pebbles around. You know, there was a Chinese version of this came along later on, where you put the beads on wires and you change the algorithm a little bit. But it's the same idea. You just move things on a board and you have the different columns that do different things. And when you've learned the rules of that thing, you don't need to think about it. You just move the things and you know, you can find videos on YouTube of people doing it very fast. So one of the methods was using some form of mechanical device like an abacus board or a wired abacus. Okay. The other method was finger counting. Now that isn't just 1, 2, 3. A system was developed over many hundred years of finger reckoning, which was good for arithmetic for numbers up to 10,000. And the traders became extremely good at calculating with numbers with an upper limit of around 10,000, using the fingers in various positions and combinations of the fingers. You know, anyone who's tried to program a Japanese wristwatch knows that you can get a lot of complexity, but it's very confusing unless you master the rules, or the Rubik's Cube or something. So just by using combinations, people were able to do the arithmetic. Those are the methods, finger arithmetic or abacus boards. Both of them require quite a lot of training. I mean, to become facile, especially with finger arithmetic, is extremely complicated. Books written in the 12th, 13th century showed you how to do it, including books written by Leonardo. But it was complicated and took a lot of practice. Hindu Arabic arithmetic, on the other hand, is so simple that you can teach it to a five-year-old child, and we've been doing that ever since. You just have to write the numbers and columns with the lined up on the right, and just do things in the columns and do carries and things. You can just learn the rules and carry on that computation. So one thing that happens with the, because you need sort of paper to do this. So you couldn't do this in the days when people were writing on the sand. It wasn't the best way of doing it. So this was when there was enough paper available, when paper was something, when writing materials were cheap. Things had to be in place. So then people start using this thing. And there's another advantage to the Hindu-Arabic arithmetic system, which is incredibly important for commerce. Your calculation keeps a record of every step. It's its own audit trail. If you're in business, and you're in business in a society which is more than two people trading, you know, most of the Muslim traders, it was people on camels trading one-to-one. But the moment you got to the point where some person had a trading empire or a trading company, where you sent people to negotiate for you, you wanted to be able to keep track of where the money went. So it wasn't enough that someone went out and did a calculation. You needed a record of that calculation. Hindu-Arabic arithmetic keeps its own record. If someone does the calculation in the company book, you can track the calculation. You can see what was going on. So this was a system that anyone could learn. You could practice it a little bit and become good at it. And it kept its own rate, it kept its own audit trail. So this was an incredibly powerful method for doing arithmetic. So much so that when Leonardo was clearly completely smitten by it, when he was finished working with his father, he travelled around a bit in the Muslim Empire, talked to traders, found out a little bit more about this, learned this new thing called algebra, which had been invented in 9th century Baghdad, the name coming from the word algebra, which is a technique for solving an equation. And one of the things that happened when the Arabic-speaking, Persian-speaking traders and scholars in that part of the world, when they picked up this method, they generalized it, they beefed it up, and they figured out a way of doing arithmetic at scale. They scaled it up by providing standard methods. That gave us modern algebra. Okay. So Leonardo sees all of this, he learns more about it. When he goes back to Pisa, he ends up writing a book, which means you sit down and you write in longhand, in Latin in his case, and you write what is an incredibly large book. So he writes Libri Abaci when he goes back to Pisa, at least he finishes it when he goes back to Pisa. The word abacus, by the way, he did spell abacus with two B's. I like to think that he realised that in the days of early search engines, you want to misspell the word so yours comes up at the top if people look for it. It's one of the things that we get. It sounded kind of strange, but anyway. Maybe so. It could have been probably went well. Yeah. Oh, there it comes. Yes. I promised you. See, it's one of those days. I'm on a roll. Okay. He deliberately misspells this too. And interesting, because scholars since then have often tried to correct the spelling, but no, he knew what he was doing. You know, he wanted it to be different. Okay. My agent actually tells me that one word in the title has to be a word you make up or misspell deliberately. It works, especially in the search engines. Okay, but so it means the book of calculation. It was the book of doing the arithmetic without the abacus, if you like. So it makes no sense to call it the book of the abacus. It was the book of the non-abacus. Okay, it was finished in 1202. That book has generally been credited with bringing the Hindu-Arabic number system and its arithmetic to Europe. It certainly wasn't the first thing that brought the Hindu-Arabic numerals to Europe. They'd been coming in for the last 100 years or so before that, 150 years. However, what this did was bring in a very accessible way, arithmetic using Hindu-Arabic arithmetic. And that was new. And so it was generally credited to Leonardo through this book, Libri Abaci, of launching the modern commercial world. Okay. I'm going to be following, I'm opening up a lot of threads now that I will eventually tie together. Okay. So the standard story is this. This is the story we tell all the time at the beginning of a sort of math class for undergraduates or whatever. We say this number system began in the first 6 or 7 centuries of the current era, was formulated in a book by Brahmagupta around the 7th century time, where all of these things were written down, including zero and all of the rules of arithmetic. It was then taken by the Muslim traders, carried north on the Silk Route, until the 9th century, when Al-Khwarizmi, whose name, he gives us the name algebra, he also gives us the name algorithm, because he wrote two books. One book describing the algorithms for doing arithmetic, and then another book describing the algorithms for doing arithmetic at scale. And in the title of that second book, he uses this phrase algebra, and so we now call that stuff algebra, which actually means it could be dangerous getting on an airplane with an algebra textbook these days. Be careful. Look a week ago in the news in California, if you think I'm joking. It's getting really scary on the airplanes these days. Not because of terrorists, because of the TSA and all the other stuff going on. One of the least risks we fear in the United States is terrorism, right? Do the math. Okay. And then we say Al-Khwarizmi sort of wrote this in two books. And this is a story of books. In those days, books tended to be very influential. A book became a leading book. And that sort of sent the thing on its way. So we've got a book in the 7th century, a book in the 9th century, and then another book in the 13th century, Leonardo of Pisa's book, and that was supposed to have taken this Hindu-Arabic arithmetic, brought it to Europe. It certainly did that. But the other claim was that it then led to everything that people did with arithmetic. The question, however, was that part true? This is what happened. Okay. Within a few decades of the appearance of Libri Abaci, we have, coming out of that one little part of the world, banking, using from the original word banker. Because basically bankers travelled around and they would set up on a tree stump or a bank, and that's where they would do the money work. So you have banking beginning. You have insurance coming out of that part of the world. You have the beginning of genuine international trading empires stretching north through Germany and then through Europe. You have double entry bookkeeping coming out of Florence. And all of this happens within a few decades of the appearance of this book, Libri Abaci, written by Leonardo Fibonacci. So that is one incredible correlation. The question, as always, is there any causation going on? And so there was always a question mark as to, whoops, too fast. There was always a question mark as to whether Leonardo was actually the cause of that. Book appears, lots of stuff happens.
What are the colored regions? Are they significant for your story here? The colored regions on the map?
Which is the?
The colored regions, the blue, the brown, etc.
Oh, that was, this was the best map I could find of what Italy was like in the day, in the 13th century. This is a representation of the different, whatever they were of. They're bigger than the city-states. But those are the regions of Italy that were significant in the medieval period.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Alrighty. So, it is worth remembering that Italy was sort of in large regions and even smaller regions, each of which had their own currency. So doing trade in those days meant you had to constantly convert currencies. One city converted to trading with another, you had to do lots of trade. So the arithmetic was huge. Multiplication and division was absolutely central to that. You had to do it with everything. The weights and measures varied. The currencies varied. In fact, those turned out to be the clues to answer the question whether Leonardo was responsible. Because you can put a time stamp on things, and you can put a geography stamp on things, you can follow the spread of the ideas, you can follow the growth of arithmetic by looking at the numbers that were used in the examples in the books. Because when a book was copied, and all the books were copied by hand, when someone copied a book from Umbria, or from let's say from Tuscany to Umbria, not only would they put it in the local dialect, of one of the vernacular Italian dialects, they would change the currencies to the local currency, they would change the weights and measures to the local ones. So by looking at all of the examples in textbooks, you can put dates on when things were written. And that's part of what happened in reconstructing the entire story we have about Leonardo. I mean, I wasn't doing that research. I was the first person that came in from outside as a sort of a journalist, if you like, and read all of that research and saw what they'd been doing. Okay. So there was always this question as to whether the appearance of Libero Abaci was the pivotal thing. Now you might say to yourself, well, there was nobody else of fame around at that time. He was the one with the mathematical ability. He spent those years learning it from the Muslim traders and the scholars that he'd met with. So you know, he had all the knowledge, he brought it, he published a book. So, you know, who in his right mind or her right mind would object to that? Well, the answer is historians objected to that, because it turned out there was a big, big question mark in that data. And that question mark wasn't resolved until 2003, a year after I started my project. Boy, was I lucky. One thing I realized, there were many reasons to not start and spend several years writing a book on Leonardo, because there was nothing known. But I thought, I want to know. I just want to know for myself. I'm going to do it. And I got lucky. And then I got lucky, and then I got lucky. For at least five times, I got unbelievably lucky, with the result that at the end of by 2010, I was able to sit down and write a book. In fact, I've sat down and wrote two books, and I'm just writing a third book to sort of summarise the whole process. But I just got lucky. You know, sometimes it makes sense to just go ahead, and you'll get lucky. And I'll talk a little bit about the luck later on. There were some incredible strokes of luck that allowed me to move forward with this project. We'll come back to the obstacle. So why did people think that he might not have done it? And it was a big obstacle, and I'll come back to that. First, I want to just say a little bit about the guy himself. Okay. Well, actually, I did want to do that very briefly. All of that stuff about the financial world I just mentioned, about him sort of having an impact on trade and commerce, you don't have to just take my word for this. No less a scholar than a very distinguished finance professor at Yale, William Goldsman, roughly the same time as I was doing my research, he was doing his research. But by the way, the reason we did this was that in 2002, an English language translation of Libero Abaci came around. And he and I both got a copy, and we both read it, and we looked at it from our own perspectives. I used it as a way to try and get inside Leonardo's mind. He was looking at it to see where did modern financial instruments arise. And by looking at the book as a finance professor, he interpreted in a very different way. This is fine for him because you're not expected to read it, but this is just a summary of some of the things he said, that basically everything for which people have got Nobel Prizes in economics can be traced back to stuff that's in Libero Abaci. So you know, Leonardo would have got a Nobel Prize in economics if there'd been one then, we might like to think. Okay. So let's look at this guy himself. Leonardo, that's a the beginning of a manuscript in Pisa, one of the versions by the way, there are 14 copies of at least parts of Libro Bacci in existence. Three of them are almost complete copies. One's in Siena, one of the complete ones, one of them is in Siena, one's in Pisa. One's in Siena, one's in Florence, I'm coming to think of another. One's in Siena, one's in Florence, and one's at the Vatican Library in Rome. So those are the three almost complete ones. And then there are another 11 copies scattered around, some in France, a little fragment in Siena and one or two others. So in Pisa and one or two others. So there were little bits of things, but three copies dating from roughly Leonardo's time. A little bit afterwards, nothing in Leonardo's original hand. Okay. This is from the 2000 and, it was one of the ones that was in, this is one of the ones I took this, I got this image made in 2002 on my first visit, I got a digital image made. But this is in the Siena Public Library, and this was written roughly the late 13th century. And what he says at the beginning, and this is a second version he wrote a little bit later, he says, "Here begins the book of calculation composed by Leonardo Pisano, family Bonacci, in the year 1202. Okay, so this is Leonardo's own hand, I mean it's his own words, copied by a scribe. The name Fibonacci was very recent. That was ascribed to him in 1838 by a historian, French historian, Guillaume Libri. I guess the name Libri is kind of just coincidentally neat. Leonardo would actually just have been known as Leonardo, or when he became distinguished, Leonardo of Pisa. That's how people would give him names. So that would have been his name. You can see why a historian would want to give him a Fibonacci, to give him a surname, because you know, it helps to sort of, not least because there was another Leonardo that came along a little bit later that was very famous. And so you need to be able to distinguish Leonardo from the other Leonardo, right? And if you say Leonardo on its own, people default to Da Vinci. You know, I'm sure that Google will, in your case, Google will default and complete to Leonardo da Vinci. In mine, it will default and complete to Leonardo of Pisa, but that's because I've searched on that many, many times. Fibonacci comes from looking at that phrase at the top, okay? Because in that book, he says that he is Filius Bonacci, which literally means son of Bonacci. But, you know, there were no surnames, so that really means I'm in the family that's become known as Bonacci because there was Bonacci's around at some point. So these, you know, names got acquired and just built up. So this really means from the Bonacci family. So that phrase composed by Leonardo, family Bonacci, that's a translation done by a successful scholar who sort of interprets it. It's not a completely literal translation. So that's really how we should interpret that. And that's where the Fibonacci comes from, Filius Bonacci. So it's a clever way of making up a name. And, you know, it's a nice name. It sort of sounds like it's been around in Italy for a long time. You could use it to open an Italian restaurant. There have been movie villains and heroes called Fibonacci. It's a nice name. Okay. And it sort of filled a hole in a history book. As soon as you mention the word Fibonacci, people say, oh, yes, Fibonacci. That's the same. The person who invented or discovered the Fibonacci sequence. Well, he didn't. It had been around for generations, hundreds of years before that. You'll find it in manuscripts going back hundreds of years. What happened was, when he was writing this book, Bacci, Leonardo wants to put in, it's a dull book. It's hundreds and hundreds, 600 or 700 detailed calculations to do with weights and measures and trading. So it's a heavy duty book. Being a good marketer, understanding you need to keep people's attention, he spiced it up with these fun little problems, including one about a fictitious rabbit problem. And this is one he just found somewhere. He'd read many books, so he'd obviously come across this one. But it gives you a good excuse to do lots of additions and get practice at addition. And this was the problem. And that's actually a statement towards the bottom. That's a direct translation from the Latin. So that was how Leonardo himself posed the problem of the Fibonacci sequence, the rabbit sequence. He didn't invent it. There was no indication in anything he wrote that he was interested in it. He almost certainly wasn't, because he was frying much bigger fish. He was changing the world of commerce. He wasn't interested in a fictitious rabbit population. But it was a fun problem. one of many fun problems that are in the book, another sort of just there as recreational mathematics problems. And if you solve it and you interpret it correctly, you end up with the answer 377 prayers. All of the other stuff about the Fibonacci sequence, about it being related to the golden ratio and so forth, that was all much later, almost certainly wasn't known to Leonardo da Vinci, much, much later. Most of the things you read about the golden ratio were actually invented in the 19th century by a German writer of popular books. And there's two, and going back to the introduction, there's two ways to write a popular book. One is you take the facts and you try to make them interesting or bring out the interest. Another is you just invent facts. Unfortunately, the German just invented facts, things to do with the Parthenon and the beauty of the human face and so forth. You won't find those references before the middle of the 19th century, before this German book appeared with them in. So you can make money that way. You know, it seems as though we're about to decide the presidency of the United States in a similar way. But there you go, it works. Okay. One of the nice things about having dual citizenship, you can criticise two countries with impunity. And one of my passports is a European passport, so I can criticise the whole European Union and get away with it. Okay, books we are over. This is that little image I showed, that was just the very top part of this first page of this book in the Siena Public Library. I'll note that this is in the public library. You can walk in off the streets and ask to see it. Because you don't have, well, if you have an Italian citizenship and you're a member of the library, they'll just let you sort of sit down and read it. If you're a foreigner, not from Italy, they will ask you to deposit your passport with them, but then they'll bring this book and they'll just let you sit down and read it. And it's kind of awesome to sit there with a 13th century book, one of three that only exist today, and sniff it and look at it and measure it and read it and turn the pages. Absolutely astounding. There are so many manuscripts in Italy that so long as they like the look of you, they'll just let you look at them as long as you want to. So that was from the Siena Public Library. The first edition, so now let's see what he did. Leonardo had a bunch of books. He writes this one in 1202, and that was the first edition. No copies of that have been found. He completed the second edition, more than a quarter of a century later, because what happened was the first book made him famous. He became famous very quickly throughout Italy. He was a big shot in Italy. People started using it very early. Well, they started using the ideas very early. That's a hint to why there was a big question mark about his origins. Okay. He then wrote, actually at the request of the Emperor Ferdinand, he wrote a second edition much later in his career, of which 14 copies exist, three of them complete. He wrote a shorter account, and we know this because he refers to it in his various writings, which was aimed at, that first book was a scholarly book. It was written in deep Latin, it was modelled on Euclid's elements, there were axioms, proofs, derivations. It was thick, it's heavy. It was not designed for reading by a lot of people. So he writes a simpler one. He's a good marketer, he says, I'll make a simpler version that people can read. Arithmetic for dummies is what he would call it today. Brings that out, okay? But no copies exist, so we don't know what it looked like. He writes a book on geometry, practical geometry, you know, geometry for carpenters and architects. Also written with proofs, modelled after Euclid's elements. So he was writing for the scholars. Other than that first book, that shorter book, he's writing for scholars. So he has this deep book about, he's capturing all of the known knowledge. It's a geometry textbook. He then does the medieval Italian version of Jeopardy. He goes to the Emperor's palace and he's given a public demonstration of his mathematical prowess before an audience, where they throw questions at him and he answers them. And some of the answers are so astoundingly good that he writes them up and dedicates that book to the emperor. That's a book called Floss, the Flower. And then he writes what we would regard as an elementary algebra book, number theory, the Book of Squares, which for 13th century is pretty damn impressive. So he writes those and sandwiched between two versions of Libro Abaci. This is his big career. He's a big shot. He travels around. He's named Leonardo of Pisa. He ends up having a government role in Pisa. He's an advisor. He's put on a pension. He's a really big shot. And then this other stuff happens. And this was the first personal computing revolution. 1202, the first edition comes out. Since the 1960s, we have known that within a couple of decades of that book appearing, lots, increasing numbers of handwritten manuscripts appeared of basic arithmetic. Now think about it. Books are written and you want to learn something. And once it was known that there was a method for doing arithmetic, everybody wanted to do it. This was about to become bestsellers because here was how you can create your own startup company. This was Silicon Valley back in the 13th century. Here was a method that allowed, this is like acquiring a personal computer. I mean, you had to do it in your head, but it was the method. So these algorithms were powerful. People wanted them. The only way you could get them is by writing your own books. So typically what people did was they would borrow whatever copy of the book had arrived in town, if it's Florence or Lucca or wherever, the book would come in, you'd get a copy, you'd write it as quickly as you could, you'd make a copy, you'd give the original back, and then you'd start to work through your copies. So you'd write your own book, then you'd read your own book, and then you would work on your own book in the margin. And many books, this is one of them, looked like that. It was copied, faithfully we assume. Then the person started to work through it and had diagrams and doodles. This person liked to doodle when he or she was thinking about arithmetic and wrote things in it. So there were hundreds of these things written. Actually, there were probably thousands. 250 have survived. Since they were written by individuals for their own use, you've just got to make a wild guess. If 250 have survived, of books that have no other value than to the person, how many thousands must have been written in that period? These were not discovered until the 1960s. Why wouldn't they be discovered? These were not books written by famous people. These were books written by ordinary people that somehow had managed to survive and find their way into the archives. Here you can even see the growth. And these are the ones that have survived and that have been catalogued. There's one that was in the, actually the one on the top right is the one that we know from the 13, from 1294. Then there were 8, 10, and they went up and down. And then they reached this sort of the largest number around 1476 to 1500. And you might ask yourself, what happened around 1476 that would have meant people stopped hand copying books? Well, think about it for a minute, we'll come back to it. But people did, for whatever reason, stop hand copying books. But this was a period of growth. This was before social media, right? These had to be carried on the backs of camels or horses or whatever, mules or horses. So these were individual books. But you've got a growth. You've got a huge growth. Not only was that, all over Italy, you had these evening classes, these schools set up to go and learn commercial arithmetic, practical arithmetic. We have records for at least 20 in Florence alone in that period. So there was this growth of interest in arithmetic, fueled by, we assume, the appearance of Leo Abaci. Okay. After which, there was no more record of Leonardo. In many of those books, these handwritten books, the author would say, this is arithmetic in the style presented by Leonardo of Pisa. And that eventually died away. But initially, people referred to the fact that this was Leonardo's style of arithmetic. It was definitely in his image. But then all of a sudden, there's no more references in the history book. In fact, he almost disappeared from history altogether. And the reason was, and this is what happened at one of that time, not too fast, he invented the printing press. Arithmetic was in such demand that after the printing press came along, I mean, everyone knows that the Gutenberg Bible was one of the first books printed, if not the first book. The second or third was a book on practical arithmetic. And then more, more, more. So among the books that were printed very quickly using the printing press was arithmetic books. Loads and loads of them. Now, of course, since currencies change, these are practical arithmetic, the book you would put into print would be the most current one, with current weights and measures, the local current currency, well written in the most accessible form. You would put recent manuscripts. You wouldn't go back 200 years to a book of great length, written in Latin by this person that's been long gone. So no one was going to put into print Leonardo's book Liber Abaci. That had already fallen into history. The dust was already gathering over that. What was put into print were the more recent books. The first one had been published just outside of Venice, shortly after the printing press came along. Okay, so that basically put the nail in the coffin for Leonardo's record in the history books, with one exception. Among the books that were printed was a book by this very distinguished mathematician. And if you Google him, you'll find that he's actually a pretty distinguished mathematician. Comes up in history of algebra and so forth. And he writes this book, Summary of Arithmetic, Geometry, and Proportions, Proportionalities. This is a printed book. And he actually, as a scholar, maintained this standard phrase that you would see in many of the early popular arithmetic books. And since we follow, for the most part, Leonardo Pisano, I intend to clarify now that any enunciation mentioned without the name of the authors is to be attributed to Leonardo. So he basically said, if I don't tell you who did it, this is Leonardo. So he made a very strong statement that all of that stuff came from Leonardo. At which point you might say, okay, why would anybody think that Leonardo wasn't the person who started this entire commercial revolution, the first personal computing revolution? I mean, it's just, come on. I mean, it all happened after the book, and I mean, it's just so much evidence. Well, here was the problem, you see. There's Libro Abaci, 1228, a one-off, essentially. You know, three copies that still exist. Maybe only 15 or 16 copies were ever written. It was a very big book, hard to follow, written in great detail. Then you've got these so-called abacus books, of which there were probably thousands. That was the one that came out around 1290. All of those authors copied from each other. And we can tap, because of the way that the currency's changed, you can do literary forensics, and you can figure out when they were written, where they were written. You can sequence these things. They were copying from each other all the time. Sometimes they did it with attribution, mostly they didn't, because they were just writing for themselves. These were people's own notes. Copied. So you compare any two of those, you can see which one came first, all of the overlap. There was virtually nothing in common between any of those thousands of books and this one. The mathematics was in common, but none of the examples, none of the exposition, none of the phraseology. That book was certainly not copied to produce any of those. Something else came in between them. Now, the assumption was Leonardo's book written for merchants, his little book, his Arithmetic for Dummies. Seems obvious, but teeny-weeny little problem. We don't know what it looks like. And without the evidence, I mean, you know, you get off, right? This is not beyond reasonable doubt. I mean, this will work in a civil court, but not in a criminal court, right? You know, there's a preponderance of evidence, but this is not beyond reasonable doubt, because there is a reasonable doubt. And there were scholars who actually built their careers, I mean, I don't know what they're doing now, but they built their careers on saying, no, it wasn't the case, and actually gathering considerable evidence against it. They were good scholars, because there's a lot of evidence you can put against this happening. Okay. The way this was resolved, and I know the time is coming on, but this is a story with a very fast ending, okay, is you ended up looking at all of his other books. One of the things that happened with these practical arithmetic books, these many of them, they often included a chapter on geometry. But geometry is not in Libro Abaci, it's in his practical geometry book. So it looks as though Libro Abaci and his book on practical geometry, the material in those, both of those, fed in to this book on these books on practical arithmetic, these thousands of them. So the assumption was absolutely that when he wrote the smaller book, it was a summary of both Libro Abaci and practical geometry, both arithmetic and geometry, and it was written in a fashion that made it accessible to people to start copying. Whether Leonardo wrote that in vernacular Italian or Latin, we don't know. Someone may have translated it, but it was written in a form that was accessible. Wouldn't it have been nice to know what it looks like and just nail this sucker? This is one of the points where I got lucky. Because one of the people I got to know on my 2002 visit was a person called Raffaella Franchi. And in 2003, she found the copy. Wow. I might have a book, and you know, so the next thing, I turn it over to the library where that's found, and on another visit, because I couldn't get in at that time, so I had to leave. You know, I still had a day job in Stanford. So I went and looked at that thing. Okay. This was the missing link. Here's the person who found it. She was a former algebraic geometer, and then algebraic geometer topology sort of person. And then she just turned into history and became a... She now directs the Centre for Medieval Mathematics at the University of Siena. There she is in her office. If you walk through that door, which is about 20 metres north of the Duomo in Florence, through that street and you go through that nondescript door, when you get past the guard, which you won't get past, but I do because I've got a pass, I got lucky. You can't get into the archives in Italy without a pass. You can only get a pass if you're an Italian with a lot of archival history, or you get lucky and someone arranges for you to get a pass, which gives me, I actually have a pass that will get me into any archive in Italy. Yeah. Over drinks, you can bribe me and I'll tell you how you get one of those passes. It's one of the most valuable possessions in my life. A Stanford library card did not get me through that door, but this pass got me through instantly. That leads you into this beautiful room. And in that beautiful room, you find this manuscript. And that is a very early copy, probably a first edition copy, of Leonardo's Book for Merchants. And it's and you can then look at how the ideas spread throughout that entire genre of thousands of books. So at this point, we are looking at the book that launched the modern world, at least in the first or second copy. And you can see how the person had sort of written it and then started using diagrams and working through it. And there's bits of geometry in there.
Is it in Latin or Italian?
This is in Italian.
Or Italian?
Yes, the answer is yes. This is Italian. This is a book in vernacular Italian, yeah. It begins with that phrase, but then it was an early one. People did that in the early days. Leonardo was barely in his grave at this point. So people did do that. That itself tells you nothing. That only became significant when Pacioli used that phrase. But we now know that this was the chair. Liber Abaci, the book for merchants, and then all of that. That actually is an abacus book that sold for about $500 million in New York a few years ago. It's a bound version of these things. They weren't bound in the time. We now know what that thing is. We've got its contents. And part of the reason it was important to know the contents was lots of other scholars jumped on and got collaborating evidence. So lots more linguistic forensics sort of nailed the fact that, and this is just one page, this is meant to be emblematic of the fact that there's a bunch of papers that show that this thing all fits together. This is as good an evidence as you're going to get. So now we can go back to that question. And we can remove the question mark, which is much easier to do with Keynote than it was back then. But sometimes technology is faster than the historians. So now we do know that that was what happened. Okay, I'm going to finish by just showing you some of these manuscripts, because they're just cool to look at. If you want to see the one in Siena, you can see it. It's a public library book with a reference in the public library. In the days when I went, it had a beautiful entrance. But then they put sort of devices to prevent you taking in things to blow it up. And so you have to go through a different door and you have to go through a security thing. But back in 2002, it was a delightful place. It looked like an old hotel where you might expect to see Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall walk out or something. And when you walk through, you'll be given this book. And here's some of the pictures I got images made of these things, high definition digital images. Notice that the calculations are in the margins. If you're interested, I'll tell you why the calculations were in the margins and not in the text later on at the end in the Q&A. I just want to show you some of these. Notice that they also tended to write the numerals in red to distinguish them. Again, diagrams in the margins rather than in text. There was a good reason for that. If you go to the Florence Central Library and you've got one of these magic cards, you can get in to see this manuscript, same contents, just looks a little bit different, has a different feeling, different smell, different texture. I mean, there's nothing like having a book in your hand from the 13th century. And trying to imagine how many people looked at this and learned it and set up empires and things. There's also some memorials you can look at. There's the statue I've already mentioned in the Camposanto. There's various images of it, including images of it when it was previously in a public park where the pigeons used it as a restroom, as you can see from all of the gunk on it. And that's the plinth describing the origins of the statue. And also, this is on the banks of the Arno, near to that bridge that we saw that had been destroyed. You go along there for 100 metres or so, and in what is the city archive, you'll find a plaque on the wall, which is a commemoration in the 19th century, after they rediscovered him. This was after Leonardo was rediscovered. Pisa realised that they had got this famous ancestor. So they moved fast to create statues and to create plaques and things and to honour him. There it is in situ, in this building. In it, they give us a little bit of information about Leonardo. We know he was still around in 1241 because he was honoured by the city. So this is the evidence we have that he was recognised as a big shot in his own lifetime and remained so until the printing press obliterated him for 300 years. And Pisa has a bunch of streets, at least that has a street with a bunch of street signs named after him. This is the Lugano Fibonacci. And I went round and took the photos of the various numbers. And in Florence, they have a street in which there are no fewer than 11 signs for Via Fibonacci. And the street's only about 200 metres long. And there's these signs everywhere. There's some of them. And there's the rest of them. And there's also a building, which is the Association of Computing Professionals in Italy, which is appropriately in 12 Via Fibonacci. I guess 12 is the best they could do. Not a Fibonacci number, but it's still a good one. I bet they tried to get it somewhere else. So there's a street with those things. And finally, that was the book I wrote in 2011, or published in 2011. One of the things that struck me when I was doing this research was, since I was commuting back and forth between Palo Alto and Tuscany, I was struck by the uncanny similarity between Silicon Valley in the 80s, which was before I went there in the late 80s, but in the days when the Macintosh appeared and personal computing took off. And I was actually in Palo Alto when that, so just after that happened. And what happened in Italy, it was so detailed. I actually went and got Stephen Levy's book about Stephen Levy, if you prefer, how you want to pronounce it, his book about the creation of the Macintosh, insanely great. And I went through the entire book, and I basically just replaced the word Steve Jobs by Leonardo, and the book was accurate about Fibonacci. It was staggeringly accurate, and it was so accurate that I put it in a book. And my agent said, hey, this should be an e-book. You've got a written book about Leonardo, we should have an e-book about how Leonardo was just the first personal computing revolution. So we brought out this much cheaper e-book, Leonardo and Steve, the young genius who beat Apple to market by 800 years, which he did, exactly the same passageways. And to finish with, here is why it's sort of uncanny. This is the beginning of why this is an uncanny comparison. They both changed the world by making a very accessible book, a laptop in one case, or at least a computer, and a handwritten book in the first place. These are modern dressings, because that statue doesn't have a manuscript, it's got a bound book. And that's a sort of a modern version of the thing. But they both produced a device that made something very accessible to ordinary people. Neither of them invented what it was. It was an interface issue. Hindu-Arabic arithmetic is just a better interface to arithmetic than the Roman numerals. That's a better interface than anything that came out of Redmond, Washington. And in both cases, it was all about marketing. I'm going to finish by just pointing out a couple of elements about the marketing that Leonardo did. Leonardo writes Liber Abaci. That makes him a famous guy. This is scholarly, professional, people listen to him. But he knows that no one's going to read it, because it's just for the scholars. So he spends time writing a simpler version, the Book for Merchants, because he knows people will read that, and by golly, they did, and were desperate to get it. Steve Jobs goes to Xerox Park in the late 1970s, sees something that allows him to build a very fancy computer, which he called Lisa, after his daughter. So the first thing they built at Apple on this model, this with the graphical user interface, was this very expensive, difficult to use, cumbersome device called the Lisa. Very powerful. It was built on a device that had been built in Xerox Park, based on the same design principles. But he knows that establishes his chops, but isn't going to sell. Too expensive, too difficult. So he builds a cheaper version, a smaller version for merchants, a smaller version for everybody. That's marketing. The ideas are established at a high level, then you take it and you don't dumb it down. You just make it accessible with really good interface and really good design. And Leonardo did that back in the 13th century. Those are the crude comparisons. You can take them down two or three levels. And what Leonardo did is exactly what Steve Jobs did with Apple 800 years later. And we are done.